This is the Art of Darkness podcast with Kevin Kautzman
and Brad Kelly. We're a couple of very online writers interested in the dark side of what drives creative people to create against all odds.
This show is about art and the people who make it, what it costs them, and what it takes to bring something unique and impactful into the world.
Each episode, we excavate the life and work of an artist you might think you know.
Don't worry, they're all safely dead.
On every episode, we try and find out just what the hell was wrong with them and how they worked through their darkness to create something that lives on after them and continues to move culture.
Find us online at artofdarkpod.com and on Twitter at artofdarkpod. All right, we've got some sponsors for the pod now.
Wait, what?
Every link you need for the things we talk about here is at artofdarkpod.com/sponsors. First up, books.
If you're into this podcast, odds are you're probably a reader. We've got links to buy new books from bookshop.org and used books from Alibris.com.
And if you want to listen to your books, we recommend and use audible.com.
It's great and the catalog is huge.
All right. So if you're listening to this, you are online.
Maybe you're very online.
You probably have a website or are thinking of starting one. Maybe you want a website like artofdarkpod.com. We built that with WordPress, which is by far the most popular way to create websites. And the single best host for serious WordPress is WP Engine. I've personally used them for over a decade now, and I don't host my websites anywhere else. Go to artofdarkpod.com/sponsors and click on the WP Engine link to learn more.
Finally, the best way to support the show is at patreon.com/artofdarkpod. Get the bonus After Dark content for every episode, access to the book club, and more.
Thanks for supporting Art of Darkness. And I don't think that was too painful. I think we did a pretty good job there. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounded good.
Yeah. Yeah, we appreciate it. We're back. Art of Darkness, a dark room episode about PKD, Philip K. Dick, noir, neo-noir, do posters dream of electric sheep? We're here with Lomez, who will be known to many. Lomez is the impresario, the mastermind behind Passage Prize and Passage.press, somebody we've meant to have on for a while. We finally have him on. Very excited. Lomez, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for the introduction, Kevin. As you said, this is something we've been batting around for, gosh, like a year now, trying to figure out the right time and occasion to have this conversation. And it's finally here. I'm very excited for this. And thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, I am really excited. I've got to do a little bit of housekeeping. We have Art of Darkness Live coming up soon. Brad is flying into town. He's going to be the godfather to my baby daughter. So we're going to do that.
Very exciting.
Yeah, a little bit of ceremony there. And then the next day, June 5th, at Waldman Brewery, we are going to do Fitzgerald, F. Scott Fitzgerald, St. Paul's own F. Scott Fitzgerald, part one. And then my theater company, Bad Mouth Theater Company, is going to be doing a theatrical presentation of F. Scott's wonderful short story, Winter Dreams. It's free. You just go to badmouthtc.com to RSVP. Brad's going to be there. It's going to be live. It's going to be fun. There's a $10 minimum at Waldman. Do not miss it. Bad Mouth is also in the middle of a production of a play called One Good Marriage by this fellow Sean Raycraft at Phoenix Theater in Minneapolis. Tomorrow, Monday, the 22nd, we've got a Pay What You Can show. It was funny. Some guy was walking down the street on Hennepin Avenue today and was like, he looked at us. It was the actors and me. And he was like, Do y'all work here? We're like, sort of. We're doing a play. It was like he kind of wanted to hit us up for money. Like maybe we were getting panhandled. And then we're like, well, you know, but come to the show. Come on Monday. Let's pay, you know. And he's like, I don't know. I lost all my money. And I'm like, okay, it's pay what you can, buddy. So, right. You know, I said, right. Come along, bring a friend, yeah. But we'll, you know, 25 cents. Anyway, so we're doing that show for one more weekend. And if you are anywhere near the Twin Cities, you do not want to miss this Art of Darkness live event. It's going to be a lot of fun. Cannot wait to see Brad in the flesh.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Yeah,
it has. But you and I talked to you more than almost anybody else alive.
Same. So it'd be good. Yeah. It'd be good to see you. Yeah.
Here we are. And what do we have queued up? Because I know we're going to talk about Philip K. Dick. We're going to talk. Yeah. I'm sure we'll talk about the internet. I want to talk about the state of the culture or the anti-culture or what the hell's going on. And I know you have some stuff for Patreon for After Dark. Queued up.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about talking about Philip K. Dick is, and I guess for people who, if you might be tuning into this show for the first time, this is a Dark Room episode. These are actually, I love doing these, but these are really follow-ups. We already did a deep dive, like the full Philip K. Dick biography, focused on a few of the books. You can't talk about all of Philip K. Dick's work. There's just too much of it. But a great friend of the show and host of the Forest of Symbols podcast came on, helped us out with that. Great. One of my favorite episodes to do, frankly, and I learned a ton. And the Dark Room is an opportunity for us to kind of zoom in on, you know, some aspects associated with the author from somebody who, you know, maybe has a different relationship to PKD, has something to say about him. The cool thing about PKD, though, is if you take the right steps, you can end up talking about anything. We could be talking about Gnosticism, the internet, drugs, the aliens, UFO. You could take this in any direction you want to go. And, you know, over time, as we have more of these conversations about Philip K. Dick every once in a while, we'll probably cover a lot of those. I think today we're going to talk a bit about noir for sure. And I know Lomez has been reading Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which people know is the basis of the great movie, maybe one of the greatest movies, some people would say, Blade Runner, which is a classic of it's noir, but it's, well, if you've seen it, you know, it's not just noir. So we're going to talk about that in the After Dark. We're going to, you know, continue whatever threads we pick up here. But I also want to talk about speed. Because as I was thinking about Philip K. Dick, some of the other artists associated with him, I realized that speed, amphetamines, are a huge part of 20th and 21st century American culture, often very little talked about. And so I'm going to just kind of touch on that a little bit. Like, what is up with that? I'm curious, Kevin, like, what do you think? And we'll save the meat of the conversation. Like, Kevin, what do you think is the effect of Adderall on culture, for instance, and Lomez too? I think it's pertinent. I think of everything you read on the internet, half of it was written by somebody under the influence of Adderall. What does this all mean? How does this tie back to Philip K. Dick? So that's someplace we're going to go in the After Dark, patreon.com/artofdarkpod. I'm talking real fast because as soon as I start talking about Philip K. Dick, I'm trying to keep up with him. So. Hmm.
Yeah.
But no Adderall involved. I promise.
My only interjection there is like, if we're talking about the influence of speed on 20th century, you know, cultural life, I would just have to say I was not prepared to enter this conversation to talk about Hitler, but,
oh no,
if we're going to start with his speeches and his motivations, I suppose we can't have a conversation about that without mentioning Hitler. But anyway, that's the kind of thing I suspect we should say for the,
We would definitely go there. So,
and one of our, we just did Lenny Riefenstahl, and one of our ongoing jokes on the pod is that when we finally want to kill the pod, when Brad and I are finally done, we will destroy all our social media, do the episode about the Austrian corporal and vanish. And that's the end of the pod. So if you haven't seen the Hitler episode drop yet,
we're still going.
It means that the pod is still going. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
So let's, I mean, we can kind of start anywhere here. Lomez, you're reading Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Was that your first time? I'm sure you've seen the film Blade Runner. I don't know how you can be like Gen X or millennial guy who's at all interested in films and not seen Blade Runner.
Yeah.
But what did you make of the novel?
Yeah. So It's interesting. I mean, yeah, Blade Runner is a seminal film, not just sort of in general for, you know, Hollywood and cinema of the last, you know, 50 years, but in my own sort of personal canon and my formative sort of artistic years, Blade Runner played a very significant role in that. I love that film. The writer of that film, David Webb Peoples, also wrote Unforgiven, which is maybe, aside from Blade Runner, one of my other favorite movies. And actually, on sort of a rewatch and thinking about noir, I think there's a lot of similarities here between Westerns and noir, which is something I think is worth getting into. Noir is kind of the end point, the terminus of the Western. You know, it's next phase, and the cowboy sort of becomes the hard-boiled detective in a sense. And that's something that I think is worth investigating a little bit here, and why David Webb Peoples, of all writers, makes sense for both of these films. But I did, for the first time, after you guys posed this episode, pick up a copy of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? I hadn't read it before. I'd read quite a bit of other Philip K. Dick novels, but this was my first foray into this particular side of things. What I was struck by was how dissimilar it is to the film. And it's much more, you know, the characters of Do Androids, the Deckard character in particular, the male protagonist, the main protagonist, is this kind of almost like, you know, hapless literary figure. He's not this sort of hard charging master of this, you know, wilderness in which he's thrust, you know, in the way that Decker is the master of the city and kind of knows all its ins and outs. And he's, you know, other characters sort of make fun of him, and he's got this strained relationship with his wife, this very kind of literary, realistic, domestic relationship, which is reminiscent of some of Dick's older novels, his early novels. I'm thinking of one novel about like a typewriter salesman, Milton Lumpke. Have you ever read that one? So
I haven't read that one.
It's a kind of Willy Loman-esque, you know, satire of this kind of average guy. And that's what the novel had, more of that tone. And there's all sorts of elements in it that aren't in the novel. There's this whole sort of religion, a kind of Scientology's like religion called Mercerism. It plays a central role in sort of the themes of the novel. It takes place in San Francisco rather than LA, which is a really significant difference. And if you look at the difference between noirs that take place in San Francisco versus LA, like Sam Spade, Maltese Falcon is a San Francisco noir versus all of Chandler's Big Sleep stuff is LA noir. Or like there's another San Francisco noir called Dark Passage. It's a Humphrey Bogart Bacall noir. They have a different, very different feel than LA, and LA is a very different kind of place than San Francisco. So I think that's a very critical difference. And I'm curious about why Peoples and Ridley Scott decided to place Blade Runner in LA, although I think it's the right choice.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, they ramped up the noir aspects for sure. Totally. Right. And yeah. it turned it into, it's almost like, if you look at the history of cinema from a certain perspective, it's almost like the last noir in a way, right? Like it's sort of like put the end cap on all of it. Not that there hasn't been films after that, but it was sort of like everything that noir had to say sort of terminates in Blade Runner to a certain extent.
Yeah, between Blade Runner and Chinatown.
Yes.
Yeah. If you did a double feature of those, that'd be a long night. But yeah. Maybe some speed would help you get through it.
So, well, right. I wonder about that, because then you think about like Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction or, you know, Big Lebowski is definitely like an L.A. noir. What happens is those become so sort of self-referentially noir, right, that they almost become something else. Like there's this layer of illusion that gets so heavy on top of the just sort of vanilla noir that you sort of, it becomes a separate genre. And right. Blade Runner's sort of going in that direction. I mean, with all of the sci-fi elements and stuff. But yeah, it's a So I guess I'm rambling a little bit. The other main difference, though, I think, like, which is really crucial as I was again rewatching the movie, is that I kind of just skimmed through the book. I didn't read it as carefully maybe as I should, and perhaps I'll go back to it at some point. But the relationship between Deckard and the AIs that he's hunting doesn't really have any real ambivalence to it. I mean, it's in the movie, there's this critical turn where, in fact, the entire movie works only because at the end there's that great scene with Rutger Hauer and the, like, you know, the tears like rain line, mm-hmm. where it becomes ambivalent about who the hero is, you know, and good and bad, and what the moral frame of this story is, which is so critical to noir. I mean, that's kind of the like a sort of definitional stamp on how noirs are defined, that kind of moral ambiguity. Whereas in the novel, he just like sort of goes about killing all these people and there's no real like remorse or anything about it. Like that kind of ambiguity about his calling and what he's doing just isn't there. I mean, there's other points of tension that, and Philip K. Dick is such a great writer. It's not like there's nothing there, but it's
he's just making different choices.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing too, and I've noted that difference in the film and between the film and the novel as well. There's also, the film is pretty ambiguous about Deckard's status as either a human or a replicant. And the novel, correct me if I'm wrong, the novel's pretty clear that Deckard is a human, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that is not part of the tension at all. That is not really a mystery. And again, there's this clear line between Deckard and these Andes, what they're called in the book, that he's hunting. Whereas in the film, again, like a major theme is the blurring of these lines where
you kill this woman replicant and it's like, well, what, you know, what's, you just do that because it's your job? Like,
In the femme fatale, quote unquote, who he kind of has this sort of quasi love affair with in the film. Again, that ambiguity over her status as like a fully, you know, empathic or deserving of empathy human being, or being, not human being, but being of some kind, is a central sort of moral question of the film. That, to my memory, just doesn't come up in the book. It's just not part of what's being questioned there.
Yeah.
Well, and this is one of my favorite things about Blade Runner, which is probably obvious, but I also don't hear it brought up a lot, how that film is in conversation with the medium of film itself. Every time you turn on Blade Runner, it's like a robot. Film itself is like a robot. It never changes. It's just, it's like a computer script running from A to Z. But of course, it's also a Rorschach test, depending on when you watch it, where you are in your life. But you contrast that to a novel where the human is very involved in the reading of a novel. It's quite a different animal, but it's brilliant for them to transition and to make the film itself part of the metaphor of what it is. That's often a sign of great art. Yeah.
So you're saying, like, in some sense, the film is itself like a Voight-Kampff test.
Yes.
And your like response to it,
correct,
is somehow indicative of your humanity and your ability to sort of understand its themes. That's really interesting. That's kind of a fascinating idea.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Yeah, that's well done. Yeah, there is this. It's an interesting relationship for me between Philip K. Dick and the novel and the film, because it's one of these rare instances where I think PKD is, I think he's some kind of genius, you know, on the sentence level. I mean, I'm sort of a style emphasis in some ways. And so at a sentence level, I'm always not that thrilled about his writing, but just conceptually he's leagues above almost everybody. And I also am loath to admit that a film is better than the book that provides its source sometimes, but this really feels like, the novel is like the first draft of the film or something, or an earlier draft of the film. And they really got the formula down right when those guys got together and made that film. And I think the noir aspects of it, and I mean, I got thinking about noir the last couple of days, like what is it? I'm glad you brought up the Western element. And I think that's very true. There is this aspect of like, you've got the Western, which is sort of these frontier stories. And then it kind of the westward expansion, the optimism and all the hope, yes, and potential of that hits the West Coast. And like, that's it. There's nothing, yep, now. And a lot of the noir is about...
That's how Lebowski ends, of course, is they throw, yes, Donnie's ashes, right, into the ocean and the breeze blows them back.
Right, 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 right. Because, yes, there's no further to go. And yeah, that's beautifully put. And then noir has to be often is there's something about negotiating, like the hero in the noir is always sort of an anti-hero, but he always has like some element of a code, right? Yes. There's some inviolable rule that he has. It's not the law, and it's not like decorum or anything, but there's always like a line he won't cross. And part of the tension's about the pressures to cross that.
Yeah.
And then, so you're always kind of negotiating with her, like, is there anything that means anything? Well, the only thing that means anything is this rule that I have, right? And then whether or not you're going to break it. And that kind of relates to this whole replicant thing, I think. Like, the question of whether he's a human or a replicant is sort of like, if he's a human, then maybe life means something. And if he's a replicant, then it doesn't.
Yeah.
And so there's this sort of playing with this notion of nihilism.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think so. Maybe one of the central features that binds the noir and the Western is the sense in which there's this single character, this sort of loner figure, who's called upon by virtue of circumstances that pre-exist whenever you're entering his story, mm-hmm, that he's been called upon to enact a kind of order onto chaos or lawlessness or this sort of wilderness. And in the case of noirs, the sort of wilderness of the frontier of the cowboy is just converted into this urban wilderness. But it's all the same kinds of, it poses all the same kinds of sort of existential obstacles, the lack of any kind of social moral consensus. I mean, these hard-boiled noir detectives are just surrounded by like debauchery, and it's completely alien. So nobody's sort of from these places. It's just a sort of maximal hostility and antagonisms, and this kind of almost like Darwinian or sort of Hobbesian view of the society. And so the question is then, where does like morality sort of derived from? How is it reached? And it's just through the sort of sheer willpower and discipline, self-imposed discipline of this like single character, mm-hmm, and just what obligations are entailed by the problems of other people around him. So they're just getting like called into these situations almost reluctantly in every, mm-hmm, circumstance. Like Deckard doesn't want to do this. You know, right. Philip Marlowe just wants to be at the bar and drink his beer, but in walks the, you know, femme fatale, and he just thinks, I have to do this, and what happens with Blade Runner, I think what you're pointing to is where that code is clear. Like at the beginning of the movie, he has to go kill these replicants, like these evil people. I mean, the guy just like offs the cop, you know, in this like horrific fashion. But as the story unfolds, that gets complicated. And Deckard, by the end, does not have any clear sense of what his sort of moral duty is. All of these things, all of this code just sort of devolves into some kind of ambivalence and uncertainty. And this happens too with the cowboy, I think the Western cowboy. I mean, there's always this sense of something being unresolved at the end. He's riding off into the sunset to the next thing, or he resigns himself to this sort of domestic life with like, you know, the woman he meets on the trail or something, but it's always sort of unsatisfying in some way. So,
right.
Yeah.
Because there is this aspect in the Western where the figure is called in to enforce law and order on, yeah, you know, lawless environment, but like also the sense that he's actually more comfortable in the lawless environment than he would be in an environment that he's been called in to create, right? Yeah. But like, it wouldn't fit him well. And that's kind of why he's the person who can do it, because he can kind of straddle both worlds.
And it's precisely the same premise as in Unforgiven, as in Blade Runner. I mean, Clint Eastwood, for those who aren't familiar with the story, Clint Eastwood is this sort of has been, you know, bounty hunter who gets called into resolve this conflict. This prostitute's been cut, you know, et cetera. Okay, it doesn't really matter what the details are, except for the fact that it's not just pure lawlessness. It's the pretense of there being a law. So like in Unforgiven, there's the pretense of like a sheriff who's going to like create order in this town. But the sheriff is sort of is inadequate. He's not up to the challenge for whatever reason, either because he's corrupted in some way, or his code is wrong, or
he's weak.
Or the wilderness, his surroundings are too powerful for him. He's just sort of overwhelmed by them. Yeah. And the same thing in the city. There's like, there are cops. Okay. There's this pretense of order, but it's corrupted in some way.
So
it requires this outsider. Yeah. This like sort of rebel element to actually sort of bring order to this place.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Well, and Blade Runner plays with all of these tropes in such a masterful way that if you watch it with a critical eye, you're going to walk away with one set of ideas or a vibe anyway. But if you just watch it as cinema, it's pure Kino. But that's what I love about it. And when he shoots the one replicant who's the model, the sort of stripper with the snake and everything, literally shoots her in the back, right? In cowboy world, if your cowboy hero like shot a woman in the back, that's 100% the villain. There's just no way around it. But in this world,
things have been so twisted and depraved and things. It's like he's doing the right thing somehow. Yeah.
She's not a woman. That's the other.
Right. She's not human. Yeah.
He's not human, but your eyes are seeing, what are you actually seeing?
Yeah.
And also like, we know it's a movie. So there's just so many layers of potential meaning. Yeah. It's also just a damn good film.
So good. And every element of it is good. I mean, the Vangelis soundtrack is like, out of this world good. I mean,
that's one I put on sometimes. I got some work I need to do and I need to focus. I will throw on the Blade Runner soundtrack. It's just like a vibe, man.
It's unbelievably good. My wife and I watched Blade Runner. I was, you know, prepping for this, and we also happened to watch in the same sort of period of time in previous day or two, Heat, which is another just like Kino LA movie. And there's something about, in both cases, the scores, like the soundtracks, just hit this perfect kind of like 80s LA vibe that's just so great. And, you know, recalls too, it's almost like bittersweet. I know I like sound like a sort of curmudgeonly old man, but how much better movies were, you know, like in this period. There's something so magical about this, the combination of the artistry of the writing, the sort of how daring and like risk-taking it was to make that movie at that particular time. Mm-hmm. And then this insane, like sort of synth score from Vangelis and stuff is just so good.
This raises the question, is Heat noir?
I mean, it wants to be. It's neo-noir because it's the same. It's operating on these same tropes where these like outsider sort of figures are enforcing a kind of morality or code on this kind of Wild West. I mean, it really is like a Wild West shootout movie.
Right.
And what we're trying to, and again, what that movie is trying to do is create this kind of moral ambivalence between the Pacino character and the De Niro character, and get you to sort of see their mutual sort of pathologies and humanities intertwined in these complicated ways. You know, their morality, they've just chosen different sides of this divide. Now, it's done in a far less sophisticated way. It's pretty crude. And the editing's a mess. And I don't know how much you know about the filming of that movie, but getting De Niro and Pacino in the same place was like impossible. So there's this one scene where they're at a diner and you only see the back of their respective heads going back and forth in this dialogue, because they wouldn't be in the same room to film the scene at the same time.
Wait. Were they at ends, or was it just their schedules were nuts?
You know, I'm sure there's like lore about this. I don't know the full lore about it.
Yeah.
But Michael Mann, you know, he has to like contrive this weird thing. but I will say, I just want to point out, not that it matters in any way, shape, or form, but John Voight's performance in Heat is so good. It's like
the hair.
Oh my God. It's like one of the best supporting acting roles. And he just, every scene he's in, he just kills it. He steals the movie. It makes me want to see a movie based on that character.
Yeah. No, that's, I don't have any problem geeking out.
This is slightly tangential, but that great Massive Attack album, Mezzanine, those two guys were at, they weren't even in the studio together I heard. Like they were fighting. And so the one guy would like lay down a beat or a track or whatever, and then the other guy would come in and they would just like avoid each other. And then they made like one of the top five, top 10 albums of the 90s. Yeah. So, hey, I mean, art isn't always fun to do.
Right. Well, it's true.
Right. I mean, that's true, Kevin. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to tell me that twice. Me. Brad, what do you got?
Well, I had one thing that's kind of curious. So I got into looking like, how is noir? How do we understand it? Like, where does it kind of come from? And I came across this pretty interesting essay by Paul Schrader, who we all know, from 1972. This is back before he was really known as a filmmaker. He was the editor of a cinema magazine. I don't know if I actually have the name of it. Anyway, he wrote this essay about basically like trying to explain noir to people. And one thing that was kind of interesting is he doesn't even think of it really so much as a genre, but more of just a mood, which I thought was pretty interesting. A mood or a style. And he talks about a handful of things that like really like, because there's a period apparently from 1941 to 1953, where Schrader says practically every dramatic Hollywood film had noir elements.
Yeah.
Right. Even if it wasn't the full plot, didn't fully fit, there were scenes and there were looks and there were sets that were definitely noir influenced, which is interesting because PKD was 13 years old at the beginning of that period, right? So 13 to 25 in this period, Traders. I mean, most of the movies that you will watch again and again, you probably saw for the first time sometime between 13 and 25.
Well, and you know what popped into my mind just now is the great film, The Third Man. Mm-hmm. And I just popped it, you know, that into the old browserino. And it reminded me, of course, that the main character there, the protagonist, is a writer of pulp westerns.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Right.
I forgot.
Of course, he goes about as far east as you can go after the war. Mm-hmm. And so it's all of that is in play. Everything we're talking about now, that film was made however many decades ago, long time ago.
Yeah. And, you know, Howard Hawks, who directed The Big Sleep, of course, you know, famous for like Rio Bravo and his westerns and stuff. I mean, there's so much overlap there. I think that Schrader definition is right. I mean, you could probably add some stuff onto that. You'd say, okay, well, there's this male protagonist anti-hero solving some kind of complicated like riddle or crime, at the center of which is this like MacGuffin, okay, some kind of entity that we're not quite sure what its value is, but obviously has some value, some object of desire, and there's a femme fatale. And I do think it has to take place in a city. I think a cityscape is central to the noir. And I think even LA specifically, I mean, you could say the West Coast, broadly speaking, like we talked about, there are some examples of San Francisco noir. There's some San Diego noirs, actually, you know.
Oh, really?
There's, you know, season two of True Detective, all this kind of stuff. There's this. Right. So California, though, being the terminus of sort of American frontier, and where all our sort of hopes, dreams, aspirations finally resolve into reality, whatever it's going to be, which is kind of tawdry and dirty. Right. And it's sort of, you know, the mood then is this sort of, it's this labyrinthine sort of claustrophobic, corrupt, paranoid space, which is maybe why PKD is so drawn to it, you know, that it really does play on these sort of, this sort of schizo paranoia, you know, that's,
yeah,
that's a kind of central mood, I think, that is evoked over and over in noirs. So yeah, I mean, that's all right. You know, and it's literally dark. Okay. So like, yeah, one striking thing about, let's say, Blade Runner or some of these other LA noirs we're talking about, The Big Sleep or something, is despite the fact that they're in LA, it's dark and rainy the whole time.
Yeah, right?
there's one scene in Blade Runner, maybe two, I think just one though, at the very end, again, that Rucker Hauer scene as the clouds are breaking, mm-hmm, he's talking about tears and rain. That's the only time you see a blue sky.
Yeah.
You know, in The Big Sleep, I'm trying to remember if the film's this way or just the novel, but it's dark and rainy the whole time.
I'm pretty sure the movie's dark and rainy.
Yeah, Marlowe's like walking in and out of these alleyways, you know, covered, and the rain is, you know, dripping off the canopies and everything, and he's under the awning, sort of hiding from the. And it's, you know, in his first short story that was published, a story called The Red Wind. You know, it's about the Santa Ana winds blowing in, and it's like this really sort of hostile ecosystem, this environment, and it, that again, it's this juxtaposition of the aspiration and hope and mythology of this place, of California, you know, the golden dream, the glitz, the lights, that juxtaposed against this sort of bitter, dark reality in which these characters find themselves, where everything is kind of, and this is very true in Do Androids Dream in the book. It's the difference though, it's the promise of technology. You know, they have these like mood machines that are a central part of the book, but none of this really helps. He's still living this kind of mundane, boring domestic existence.
Right. They have all these robotic animals, but like what people prize more than anything is a real one.
Yeah. And so these dashed aspirations, you know, life, life being sort of resettled in this way that is, that doesn't fulfill the promise that you were sort of striking out for when you made your way to California. Right. And I think that probably resonated with a lot of people. You think about, you know, the 40s maybe, and the bomb, and the sort of paranoia coming out of, you know, that era in World War II, in this sort of bleak reality that's sort of setting over the 20th century, that might sort of be playing against, you know, and there's at the same time what's going on in Hollywood with the sort of House of Un-American Activities Committee and everything else. There's a lot of this kind of paranoia, you know.
There's an interesting, in that same Paul Schrader essay, he says that one of the reasons noir came to the fore, he has a number of them, but one of them is, he says, basically once the war had ended, it was like American society as a whole had been like trying to keep up a good face to maintain morale for the war. And then as soon as the war was over, there's like a moment of a celebration because it's over. But there's also this like hangover of like trying to fake it for years, kind of. Right. And now you're dealing with all of the pain and the paranoia and the fear that you were trying to just like survive through up until then.
Paranoia is one of the main central planks of the American style and the American character. It's integral to who we are as a people, or whatever, for sure.
And you see in all these noirs too, a Big Sleep in Chinatown, which is like heavily influenced by The Big Sleep too. You know, they're premised, like the plot, to the extent that you can even like unravel what the actual plots are in these movies, or LA Confidential is another good example of this. I mean, conspiracies. Okay. It's this guy winding through some kind of elaborate sort of elite conspiracy, you know, these architects of the city, of this sort of urban sprawl, are sort of, you know, meeting behind in sort of closed rooms, smoky rooms, you know, to enact whatever agenda they have. And you have this like one guy, this detective figure, you know, trying to unravel this conspiratorial mystery.
Right. Yeah, and that makes go ahead, Kevin. Sorry.
Well, I mean, in Chinatown, which I just rewatched, as you do. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's such a banger. It's so good. he thinks this is going to be another, spousal cheating case. Yeah, right. And for him, this is like an oil change at Jiffy Lube. I do these all the time. And that's part of the fun of it.
Oh, man. This is making me think now, too. The other key aspect here is that all these conspiracies sort of begin with some kind of sexual impropriety, some kind of sexual perversion. Okay. Mm-hmm. Double Indemnity. Big Sleep is about like homosexuality and pornography. Chinatown is this weird incestuous thing. And again, you look at like our modern conspiracies, Q or whatever else. Everything sort of begins with, Pizzagate style, mm-hmm. is centered on some Epstein. Kind of sex. Yeah, Epstein, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's like, this noir spirit, which again is, it's very closely related to the sort of this very deeply American strain of folk mythology, this sort of conspiratorial strain of American American storytelling, of American narrative, and how it all begins with these sexual perversions. And what better place to sort of highlight those perversions than Hollywood, LA,
which is in itself is like a sexually depraved conspiracy in some ways, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to throw a curveball. Yeah, go ahead, Brad. No.
Not even trying to put the tinfoil hat on. Like if you literally look at it, it's a bunch of people conspiring together to like sexually entice everybody else, right? It's not even trying to go deep on it.
For sure. Right. And now I mean, and that cat is out of the bag. I mean, every normie knows what it is now. So fun. Here's a curveball. Is Vertigo a noir film?
Okay,
what do you all think?
So I'm gonna say by the definition that like Schrader's using in terms of mood, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. But then so here's the problem though. Once you start expanding these definitions too broadly, then like we run into that problem. And maybe it's not a problem, but just that Brad was explaining, like every movie from this period starting in 1941 through 53, whatever it is in some ways a noir, and then it starts to lose its ability to kind of explain anything other than simply capturing a particular mood. So is there some, like in Vertigo, I'm trying to think, is there some kind of moral sort of driving force behind that?
Trying to think the plot, and then Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, the plot involves this woman, basically, there's a doppelganger involved, right? But what I can't remember is exactly how that works. It's like his wife, a doppelganger of his wife, or just a woman.
Well, here, let me read it. So this is the plot. After a rooftop chase in which a fellow policeman falls to his death, San Francisco detective John Scotty Ferguson retires out of fear of heights and vertigo. Scotty tries to conquer his fear, but his ex-fiancee, underwear designer Marjorie Midge Wood, says that another severe emotional shock may be the only cure. Gavin Elster, an acquaintance from college, asks Scotty to follow his wife, Madeline, claiming that she has been behaving strangely and her mental state is abnormal. Scotty reluctantly agrees and follows Madeline to a florist where she buys a bouquet, and she goes to the Mission San Francisco de Assis and the grave of Carlotta Valdez and to the Legion of Honor Art Museum. So, yeah, I mean, it begins with, he's made into like a private detective.
Yeah.
Apparently, so, critically, it's split. But yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
well, no. So I'm just that this has got me thinking about other Hitchcock movies, and like North by Northwest or Man Who Knew Too Much are good examples, I think, of noir. Man Who Knew Too Much in particular has a kind of like Lebowski thing to it, where it's this, again, it's this sort of reluctant protagonist, this person who's found himself confronted with a certain obligation to do the right thing, despite A, not wanting to be in that situation, and B, not knowing what the right thing is to do, and having to kind of construct a code sort of ex nihilo out of this sort of a confusing and chaotic environment in which he finds himself. So maybe I just don't know Vertigo as well, but those do strike me as noir.
Being kind of thrown into it is part of it, right? It's not, you're being sort of sidetracked from whatever life you're trying to live, I think, is part of it. Another part of it, I think, that's common and maybe not universal is a sort of conspiratorial notion where there's a turn of realization of like, this goes all the way to the top.
To the top.
Yeah. Right. We're maybe not all the way to the top, but we're like, you start with a fairly simple problem, and then you're like, oh, well, this leads to this, and then this leads to this. And then sooner or later, somebody like the mayor is involved.
Yeah.
And they play with that consciously. I mean, Chinatown, the ending of Chinatown very intentionally reflects the JFK assassination, for example. Yeah.
I think as much as the dealing with the moral conundrums and the sort of thrownness aspect are relevant thematically, I think this notion, this sort of conspiratorial notion, is interesting too, because like it kind of reflects the crazy interconnectedness of everything anyway, right? It's sort of like, and we kind of live in that now without even delving into any particular issue. It's just like, you know, just like any consumer choice you make ends up getting tied into all kinds of things. And the next thing you know, you're sort of supporting some whatever.
Is the new Scorsese film going to be noirish? I mean, based on what I'm looking at, it seems like it might be.
Yeah, but it takes place in Nebraska, though, doesn't it?
Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah, it takes place, it looks like, in Oklahoma, maybe in Nebraska too. Yeah. $200 million budget, but it's been getting just rave reviews. So hopefully it ends up being a banger.
I would love to see Scorsese take a stab at a noir. Like probably Departed is the closest he's come, I'd say. But that spirit of kind of that mood of ambiguity and sort of claustrophobia and sort of schizophrenic paranoia. I'm trying to think of an instance in which he's really captured that. His style seems to me a little bit, it's close, it's adjacent, but it's a little different. And again, this gets back to what are definitions? Yeah.
Yeah. Fair enough. I mean, Taxi Driver certainly has elements of it. Like in that final act, it's almost like he slips into his own moment, but it's got cowboy elements.
Interestingly written by Paul Schrader.
Yeah.
Not long after this article. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder, this gets back to my geographical bias for California as the sort of definitional place for a noir. There's something about New York. It just has a different, it's got a certain kind of grittiness, of course, and darkness of its own and sort of mystery. And, you know, it can be alienating and has its own sort of characteristics and features. But yeah, I guess to me, it's hard for me to imagine a noir that isn't centered around like sort of the frontier around Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Sure. There's nowhere else to escape to.
I'm not a California guy, but I feel the same way that like a true noir takes place in California.
Because you can leave New York and head west.
Right.
So the thing about the noir is you can't leave. You're stuck there. And actually Blade Runner plays on this with the off world. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's this sort of potential, but it's off screen. Of course, we only hear about it in sort of myth, like story. And on these billboards, we don't, of course, ever see it. So there is this kind of offer of escape. And in the book, it's interesting because there's a point at which just the narrator, this third person, you know, it's Philip K. Dick speaking as this third person narrator, just says outright that nobody was sure why the people who stayed behind stayed behind. They just did. And we're not quite sure why.
Right,
it's sort of, I would...
That's actually kind of in a certain sense, that's a very realistic touch. Whereas I think the tendency of a writer would be to explain exactly why these people stay behind, right? Whereas the ambiguity is nice. I have a little thing on this geographic thing that I thought I'd be interested to your guys' take on it. It comes from a source that's a little Malcolm Gladwell, right? But it's an interesting, it's an interesting little setup. Yeah. So he says, and I'm not even saying this is right, but I thought it was interesting. He says that a Western is a world in which there is no law and order. A man shows up and imposes law and order on this community. Okay. He says an Eastern is a place where there is law and order, but law and order have been subverted from within. So like Serpico, there's like a crooked cop or something, right? He says a Northern is law and order exists and the system works and it reliably gets results. And his example is the show Law and Order, right? Where it's like, oh, a crime happens, but you know what? That darn legal system, it always gets its man. Fargo. And, you know,
yeah, Fargo. Fargo's in Northern.
Yeah. And then he says a Southern is basically the whole system is kind of corrupt in a way. And the reformer kind of has to come from outside to reform it. This is like he says John Grisham. I think he's missing an entire tradition of Southern literature here that complicates this.
He might but have the a blind spot.
The other three are kind of interesting. I like this, the Northern being that the system works and gets results. And maybe that's why Law and Order is always so boring. I mean, it's not really made for me, but it's always felt to me like, how did they make 700 episodes of the same show?
Like, are you familiar with Moynihan's Law of the Canadian Border?
No. What is that?
A sociological term you've ever heard?
No.
Moynihan, you know, is this famous sociologist from the mid-century. He had his Law of the Canadian Border. And in short, it was the closer you get to the Canadian border, the better things work. The schools are better, you know, social apparatuses work better, you know, the trains run on time, et cetera. And it's his attempt to, in some sense, explain why, you know, like Nordic countries can kind of have socialism in some ways, but you can't do that down the line. It's one of Steve Saylor's favorite sort of axioms.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, I
but
live
it's
in
true
this,
in this case.
Twin I mean, cities of Minnesota, so I don't know.
You were pretty close there. Sorry. Yeah, Kevin's like, this stuff don't work.
This was true once upon a time.
Right. Everybody's welcome to visit Art of Darkness Live. We do have one of the finest airports in North America.
That is
and probably
true.
The world. It is a fabulous airport. Great for connecting flights.
Yeah.
Great if you want to get out of town. Great if you want to visit for the long weekend.
I live in a paradoxical part of the United States where there are parts of Canada south of me.
Oh, wow.
Which is not very common. So it makes me wonder how do I fit into
okay,
all that.
Actually, yeah.
Brad, you can walk to the Canadian border.
It's really close. Sometimes when I drive down the street over here, I get my phone tells me I'm in Canada. Like it picks up Canadian cell towers. Okay. Yeah, I'm really close. Some stuff works here. Some stuff does not. But
very
I thought this was interesting that geographic dynamic. Again, he's missing a big Southern thing, but I do think there's something about the Eastern and the Northern that is correct. The noir often has a cop or somebody who used to be a cop, more commonly somebody who used to be a cop or had used to have some association with law enforcement, and they've sort of left for some reason. It's interesting.
What was his, I missed, did he have a definition for the Western?
Yeah, see, he says Western is a world in which there is no law and order. A man shows up and makes law and order.
Basically. Yeah, okay.
And then where he would, I think he would oppose that to the Southern, where in his take, the Southern is like, there is there's a law and order institution that appears robust, but is technically it's all corrupt once you look at it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I suppose that's like, true and like True Detective, maybe it's kind of how True Detective works a little bit.
Yeah, those John Grisham novels are all like that.
Yeah,
it requires a Northerner to come down,
right,
and sort of literally reconstruct the South.
Oh, we love that, don't we? Oh, we love that. We got to get Aaron. We just did a bookends reading club with Aaron Gwynn. I wonder what he would make of
nice.
That. Yeah, great.
That's cool.
Yeah, very interesting. I had forgotten how much PKD wrote. I'm on the wiki.
It's unbelievable.
44 novels. Yeah, and 121 totally short stories. Incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's really no wonder, I think, to be that prolific. And, you know, he writes, you were talking, Brad, earlier about his sort of prose style being, I don't know, sort of, it lacks a certain charisma. Okay?
Yeah, it's competent.
Yeah.
But to me, for me, it's not like, it doesn't have these moments of,
but like conceptually,
sometimes.
You know, his stories and even this thing we were talking about him leaving out like this explanation about why people didn't go has this very dreamlike quality. You know, he's tapping into the, you know, whatever that realm of sort of understanding and sort of metaphysical reality we get to visit in dreams is the kind of reality that PKD seemed to have like direct access to in ways that other writers didn't. And I think this often comes with a kind of like schizophrenia and almost like euphoria, you know, that accompanies it. And that's like reflected in the writing. And it's sort of no surprise that he went a little nuts.
Probably a bit of the speed too may have been involved. I want to ask Loma as well, while we have you, and of course we'll come back for the After Dark patreon.com/artofdark. Dark Pod. Let me do that again. Patreon.com/artofdarkpod. Get in there. Support the podcast. We put in the work. We've got some very exciting stuff coming up. We're almost halfway through the year, right?
Season three.
Season three, and we're not gonna quit anytime soon. So please, if you appreciate what we do, we get great guests like Lomez, and then the core of the show, the core episodes, like we did on PKD, like we're gonna do on Emily Dickinson. Brad's getting ready to do that. Yeah. I'm getting ready to do Frida Kahlo. Gonna be good. Support the pod.
And then Milton and Dante after that.
Nice. Milton, Dante. Yeah. And next
we're going all over the thing, all over the place.
Gonna be amazing. I think next year, I think I want to do a rock and roll summer where we maybe do like maybe four in a row of just like dead rock and rollers. That could be interesting. Yep. And then we're also gonna do the Shakespeare doubleheader where Brad's gonna prepare as if he's an Oxfordian. And I'm going to prepare as the Stratfordian, and we're both going to do, you know, we're going to release two episodes on the Bard, one from one. It's kind of going to be noirish.
Yeah.
The Bard and his doppelganger. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Does Shakespeare ever do a noir? I wonder. Okay.
No, I don't think. I mean, you know,
don't tell ChatGPT about these ideas. Keep them for yourself.
Flesh
them out.
Yeah. Lomas, you mentioned one of my favorite underappreciated pieces of media, which is TD season two. True Detective season two is a vibe. And your thumbs up gets the Lomas.
I've had quite a few arguments with people about this. I love True Detective season two, partially because I'm so in love with the LA noir. I find the landscape of Los Angeles through the lens of the noir to be maybe like sort of the most fascinating sort of literary or cinematic places that you can tell a story. It's just so rich and pregnant with opportunity to go in a million different directions. And I think that for whatever its issues that season had, which there were some, whatever, we don't need to get into that. It really captures this, again, what we're talking about is this juxtaposition, this tension between the aspiration and hopes and the sort of golden lights of Hollywood and the place of Los Angeles as a representative of really the world's dreams. Okay, this is where people want to go to get rich and fulfill their fantasies. That gets juxtaposed against this kind of darkened, gritty, tawdry reality and vice. And rather than these fantasies get being expressed through a kind of self-actualization and fulfillment, they get expressed through, you know, in the case of True Detective season two, the guy runs this gambling ring. There's all the weird sort of sex cults that you see towards the latter half of that season. And so it gets everything right. It gets all the details right. There's like that weird cult that we come across, you know, and everything else.
Yeah, damn though. And it's a vibe.
It totally is. You know, it's like this Bohemian Grove style sort of animal cult. Yeah, I don't even, you know, this weird religious new agey hippie Manson family style thing. And so we haven't even touched on like 60s era Manson family style noir stuff that gets infused into all this. I mean, so yeah, there's so much we haven't even broached here. But I really do think season two of True Detective captures all that in a way that's incredibly appealing. And I like Vince Vaughn. Okay, Vince Vaughn, you know, we talk about like Kino, these like Kino actors. I think his performance, I know people who hate it, who think he's like terrible and stiff in this role. I think he's great, and I love it. So
awesome.
Yeah, that's
good.
That's
let's revive TD2. I think we all know TD1 is just banger, all time greatest, one of the greatest seasons of television ever, no question. TD2. I don't know. Put it on.
I really like. I have aspects of it that are my favorite, but in general, I think it's
great. And shout out to Nick Pizzolatto, who wrote those.
He's the man.
Stories. He's amazing, great guy. Great writer, underappreciated.
Sure. I think isn't he getting some big movie? I can't remember. But yeah, he's on the Bird website for sure. Got to mention one final movie. Brad, do you have anything else before we go to After Dark?
No, go ahead. No, go ahead.
And maybe I'll just pepper this in and then we can come back on the After Dark. We'll talk about Speed. And then, and that's the drug, not the film, Speed.
we can talk about more.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Is Speed set in L.A.?
Pop quiz. Yes, of course.
Oh, yeah. All right. We'll talk about PK8, but also Mulholland Drive.
Yeah. Okay. We can't. Oh gosh. Are we going to get into Lynch? We don't have time. All right. We'll save that.
We'll come back.
Twin Peaks. Okay. Twin Peaks is a great noir. It's one of the best noirs, and it's like the maybe only example of a like northern noir. If you're going to talk about like a northern noir,
yeah,
it would be Twin Peaks.
I think he's trying to intentionally show you something by putting a noir in that place. That's all feels like, interesting. We could talk.
I didn't even discuss Mulholland Drive, but it is in many, many ways for sure.
We will on the After Dark. Yeah, I do too. We'll do that on the After Dark for Patreon, patreon.com/artofdarkpod. Lomez, thanks for coming on. Where can people find you? Give us your plugs. What do you got going on? Announced Passage Prize 3? Tell us.
So here's the short version. Lomez on Twitter, Passage Press on Twitter. That's the Twitter handle for the publishing company. The publishing company is Passage Publishing, passage.press. It's just passage.press. We have the second Passage Prize book will be released probably for pre-sale in the next month. That'll be printed and ready in physical copy by midsummer. We have a book coming out from Steve Saylor. That'll be ready for pre-sale in the next couple months. We got a book coming out from Nick Land that we hope to have available in the fall.
Okay.
We got a couple manuscripts for new fiction coming on board right now. It's just a process of like budgeting our time and resources. I mean, it's a fairly small operation and I can only do so much at once. So getting these books out there it takes some time, but we have a full catalog of books that we are launching for 2024. We're trying to stand up our own distribution company. You know, I mean, we have a lot of like online sort of publishers, new publishers in our space. We're trying to really kind of scale out and, you know, get these books into bookstores, get them into libraries, and really build out our own sort of parallel cultural ecosystem over here. And I believe, and I think you guys would understand this, that it begins with writing. It begins with stories. And you got to put them down on paper before you can, you know, film them and before you can stage them in a play or whatever else. So it begins with the writing, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to cultivate a sort of scene. And I think of you guys as a part of this, and there's a lot of people working in our space who are all kind of gravitating around the same project. And so what we want to do is kind of be a publisher at the center of that, help people out and help get these stories out there that better represent the world, I think, as it exists, frankly, and that isn't afraid of sort of offending our modern pieties and everything else. So that's what we're up to.
Absolutely.
That's what we're trying to accomplish.
Oh, that's awesome, man. It's a big undertaking and much respect for all you've done. Yeah. I mean, I've watched it come from like a thread where somebody was sort of like, hey, and then now all of a sudden it's like books.
It started with a Twitter thread, man. It's like that domino meme, that guy pushing over that domino.
It's awesome.
I saw the tweet between like you and Nick Land where that like manifest, which that's a hoot.
It was literally just me adding Nick Land saying, hey, we'd love to do a book. Can we do this? And he said, this is what's cool, man.
It's like, we don't need a lot of like the intermediary structures that we used to have. We don't really need that stuff anymore. So quit, you know.
One big lesson, and this applies to anybody out there who's doing creative work, whether you're kind of like in our space or doing your own thing, whatever. I mean, it really is just do it. Like, you don't need to wait for permission or like follow the XYZ steps to get to point, you know, N down the road. Just go to point N, find the quickest route to point N and just head there, you know, take whatever steps you need to, but you don't need permission. You can just do stuff.
Correct. That's right. Give yourself permission. Just like we gave ourselves permission to do this pod, and we're going to keep doing it. Lomez, rock and roll. We're going to come back for the After Dark. Thank you so much for coming on. A real pleasure. I feel like we talked about noir for like 4 hours.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. This was great. We could have gone for four more. I love this.
For sure. I really appreciate it. You're welcome anytime.